Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
This is True Crime Cast. Jamie, joined by John, as I always am. What's up?
Dude, not a whole lot. Loving this spring weather finally. It's turning into summer, though. I've been hot.
I was talking to somebody today. I don't know that we get spring anymore. It's like winter, summer, back and forth until we settle into summer. Because yeah. I think we got more winter coming.
Oh, really? Golly, I'm sunburnt. Like this morning at church, I was sweating because I was my...
Maybe the Lord's trying to say something to you, my friend.
Maybe the Lord was trying to tell me to lose some weight and maybe get my blood pressure under control because I was hot.
Maybe that's the lesson. Who knows? But yeah, it's we're getting there. We're getting into summer. And then the end of the summer, we're going out to Denver for Crime Con. Cannot wait. The lineup of presenters hasn't been released, but if you've never been... I cannot recommend this highly enough. If you enjoy true crime, you get to meet a lot of your favorite podcasters. There are sessions with people involved in a lot of the stories that you're following. Such a phenomenal event. Can't recommend it highly enough. This is going to be John's first one. You excited?
I am really excited. And I would, like Jamie, would encourage you that if you haven't been, you should use our link or our code to get a discount. Flights aren't crazy right now, so yep. Get them while they're at a good price.
And Denver's a great city anyway.
Heck yeah. Is it the Mile High City?
It is.
So, yeah, your boy will be out of breath. But I'm really looking forward to it. I know last year you got to meet, like, believe it or not, we listen to podcasts too. And we have those that we are fans of. And you got to meet some of those.
Super cool. And you didn't.
I'm going to be looking forward to that.
That's and, a day.
Dude, hold on. We got some swag.
Oh, yeah. We got some good stuff.
Like, we have some ink pens that are just awesome. I'm really excited.
Yeah, all the tables are giving stuff away, whether it's post-it notes, stickers, cups, whatever. We have a few things we've already ordered and got ready to go to either ship or take out there with us, and you can get all kinds of swag from your favorite shows, and it's such a cool place to be. Because I know a lot of times people who follow true crime feel kind of odd about it, but everybody there is on the same page with you.
Yeah, it's your family of like-minded folks.
There you go.
All right, man, let's talk about some craziness.
Yeah, this is going to be a tough one. Certainly a violent case, some kids involved. So just a pre-warning there. This is obviously one, if you've listened to us for a while, that I'm going to have trouble with. So why don't you get us rolling, John?
Fair enough. We're going to go back to December 28, 1987. We're going to go to Russellville, Arkansas. And that's where their police were responding to calls that there was a madman on a killing spree. So right off the bat, just coming in hot. So they sprang into action. They were completely unaware of the horror they would find when this was all over. So who was this man who was wreaking havoc on their town? Well, let's talk about Ronald Gene Simmons. This is not Richard Simmons.
Or Gene Simmons from Kiss.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is just another random Ronald Gene Simmons. He was born to Loretta and William Simmons on July 1540 in Chicago. When he was just 3 years old, his father died of a stroke. Within a year, his mother had remarried a man named William D. Griffin. Griffin was a civil engineer for the U.S. Army, and he and Loretta welcomed another child soon after they were married. In 1946, the family moved back to Little Rock, Arkansas for Griffin's job, and they would spend the next 10 years moving around central Arkansas.
By the age of 10, Simmons was known as the family bully already, and he's going to be the culprit we're talking about here, so everything we're talking about is going to play a role in who he later becomes. He, by all accounts, tormented his younger sister, Nancy, and his half-brother, Pete. He also lashed out at animals and hit the family cat until it turned aggressive. So he was abusing animals, one of the three of the McDonald tribe, that often gives an indication that somebody could be violent as an adult. One relative would describe Simmons as egocentric, universally resentful, and quick to blame other people. So sounds just kind of very easily agitated, quick on the trigger, often erupted in anger, and his parents were trying really hard to address these issues. They sent him away to camps for summers. They got him the help they hoped he couldn't get just sitting around the house. They tried to talk to him about his bullying habits of his siblings. They even enrolled him in the Morris School for Boys, which was a Catholic boarding school that they hoped would get him on the right track.
On September 5th, 1957, Simmons dropped out of school, and he followed in his stepfather's footsteps by enlisting in the military. I feel like that always comes up, right?
Yeah, an odd amount, I think. Yeah.
But I know so many people who were in the military and were perfectly fine. I mean, they were traumatized after what they saw, but...
And several of them, I think going to the military for some is, this is a way to go and learn a more disciplined approach to life because of whatever uncertainty you've had. And for a ton of people, it does that, and it really gets you on the right track. And for others, obviously here, it does not.
Yeah. I mean, I have family members who made a complete career out of it, but... He joined the U.S. Navy, then he transferred over to the Air Force, where he ended up stationed in several different posts around the world. While he was in the military, he actually earned his GED. In 1960, he married someone. He married Becky Yabari of Raton, New Mexico. Over the next 18 years, the couple had 7 children. That's a lot of children. During Simmons' 20 years, he was administrative specialist in the military. He served in the Vietnam War, and he was awarded a Bronze Star Medal, the Republic of Vietnam Gallantry Cross, and the Air Force Small Arms Marksmanship Ribbon. That's a lot of accomplishments, and serving in Vietnam in and of itself, just
horrific.
That was such a different war, and I think a lot of toll taken on those guys while they were over there. But when they came back, you know, in World War II, we saw the returning soldiers as war heroes. They were fighting for our country, but the country was in a phase where really split on whether or not we should even be at Vietnam. So when they came back, they were almost treated as villains instead of welcomed home as brave men and women who fought. So anyway, he retired in 1979 at 39 years old with a rank of Master Sergeant. And in the Air Force, fun fact, that's the highest that an enlisted man, non-officer, can get.
Yeah, and again, to compare this to previous cases.
Chief Master Sergeant. So Master Sergeant's a little bit below that.
Yeah, so it, regardless, he did really well. In a lot of our other cases, we see people go to the military and maybe not be as successful or not go as far. But his performance at work was exemplary by all accounts. But when he went home at night, it was a completely different story. He was very controlling with his wife and kids. He insisted that Becky stop wearing makeup, and he told her that she always had to wear her hair back and to wear long dresses because he did not want her tempting other men or trying to put herself out there to seem some type of available or interested. He took care of all the bills and all the groceries, so he didn't let her handle any money whatsoever. He went so far as to prevent his wife from, A, getting a driver's license, which they had so many kids. How does your family survive without at least 2 drivers? Or B, use a phone. She was allowed to write letters to her family, but if she got on Simmons' bad side, he wouldn't even give her stamps to mail those letters. She had to ask for permission to mail these letters or sneak behind his back to send them. And Simmons also only used distant P.O. boxes so that he could screen all of his family's mail. Nothing would be coming to the house. He would have to go and pick up all the mail, see what's coming in, and then decide what to do with it. So as far as controlling goes, he's pretty much as controlling as you can be for a leader of a family.
From 1976 to 1981, the family lived on a 2-acre property in Willis Canyon, New Mexico. But things changed dramatically in 1981 when Simmons was investigated for allegations of child abuse and impregnating his 17-year-old daughter, Sheila. On April 17, 1981, someone anonymously called in to social services. But then later, the district attorney revealed that the informant was actually Simmons' son, Gene Simmons Jr. Gene Jr. called two more times over the next 3 days, and every time he stated that he wished to remain anonymous. Now, I can tell you that where I work, your calls are taken, and they are certainly anonymous, and the family that you report on will never be told your name. So, kind of crazy in my mind that the DA revealed that it was not only his son, but, I mean, you, the person who called in was living with the perpetrator. That's not okay to reveal. So,
do they even ask for the information now? Will they ask, who are you? We promise to keep you anonymous. Or will they just say,
they
don't
do
tell
ask,
us who you are?
They do. And they ask really to see, like, are you hearing this third person? Like, are you, is this hearsay, or is this someone that you know and this is true? You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. And I think vetting that is super important. So you don't want to be responding to, I guess now we have people who do the swatting, where you'll call somebody you're playing video games on and get a SWAT team to show up at their houses. You also don't want to just be sending social services out and people be calling just to harass people that way.
Right. On April 20th, there was a caseworker who went to the home to ask questions, and that's when Sheila admitted that she was in fact pregnant and it was her father's baby. A county prosecutor was notified, and under threat of prosecution, Simmons agreed to psychological counseling for the whole family,
which was beyond necessary at this point, especially for him. In this investigation, they learned that Simmons had started sexually assaulting his daughter in July of 1980 while they were in a hotel room in Phoenix. They'd been traveling to California for a coin show, something that they enjoyed doing together. Simmons was a coin collector, and Sheila had shown interest in it. Later, they would find out that she was only pretending to be interested to keep her father happy. The investigation showed that there were two more times where he assaulted his daughter sexually, and one led to this pregnancy. Obviously, this is rape. She is underage. This is incestuous. There are so many things wrong with what's happening here. Sheila did give birth to her daughter, who was also her half-sister, Sylvia, on June 17th, 1981. New Mexico social services reports say that social workers tried to get legal custody of all the girls in the home after Simmons had, it had been revealed what had happened in the home. And Simmons insisted that the family could raise Sylvia together. And I just need to stop right here. Why is he not already in prison for this? The investigation's still happening, I suppose, but again, you know a lot more about this than I do. Is he being allowed to stay in that house with them during the investigation? Which I can see both sides of that too. You don't want to just rip families apart at every notification.
Yeah, I mean, if they had like her testimony saying that this happened, they could have at least temporarily separated the family. Like, he needs to go somewhere else and mom has to agree to keep him away. So yeah, it is kind of frustrating looking in on this case that didn't at a minimum happen.
Reports said that they'd asked the DA to get a court order for custody of the kids, but the DA claimed to never receive that request. The Simmons family went to counseling for 5 weeks in 1981, but stopped once their lawyer told Simmons that anything he discloses to social workers could ultimately be used against him in court. Once the family stopped their counseling sessions, the DA then sent the case to the sheriff's office for a criminal investigation for the sexual assault itself.
And that could be done simultaneously, so that's a little frustrating too, right? I mean, you can be charged criminally for this and also be going through the social work investigation phase. But Deputy Jeff Farmer drove to the Simmons property and met with Sheila and Becky. And Sheila refused to make any statements or comment on the situation. The law enforcement also spoke with the principal for Sheila's school, and she actually lived near the Simmons house. So when Sheila was pregnant, the principal would actually take her assignments so that she would still be able to get her work done and be able to graduate. The principal said the mother and the children seemed very friendly, but Simmons was strange. She said that he just wasn't right. She also recalled one time she saw Sheila and her father riding in the car together, but they were sitting way too close. Like, it looked like they were boyfriend and girlfriend instead of father-daughter. I remember I had a pickup truck that had a bench seat. And if I picked up my girlfriend, she would sit right next to me.
Sit in the middle.
So a lot of times these cars back in this time didn't have bucket seats like we have today. They had a bench seat. So makes you think that's probably what was happening there.
Yeah, absolutely. Given the time frame of when I grew up and seeing this, that's exactly what I pictured.
Eventually, Sheila ignored a subpoena that was sent by the grand jury and refused to discuss the incest until she was threatened to be held in contempt of court, which, that's just kind of crazy that we have to subpoena and threaten a victim of this to spill the beans.
Which, you know, we've talked about this before, whether you want to call it gaslighting, manipulation, but he is the power that he has over her in their dynamic, but also just the threats he could make against her. This is not anything to hold against her at all. It's all due back to him and his actions toward her.
I think oftentimes in victims' mind, especially children, and she was very much a child, they feel guilt as if they have done something wrong. Even though they were forced or manipulated, they feel the guilt that maybe I made something happen that shouldn't have happened.
Or she did not get in trouble. And if this ever happened to you, you did not.
Right. So, be very clear. You are a victim and you were manipulated. So then on August 10th, she did appear in court and she did testify against her father. She told jurors that her father had raped her at least 3 times. The DA said that, quote, she testified for 2 hours. She broke down and cried, and she said that she did not want her father to go to prison, end quote. I think that is a very natural thing. You know, even though your dad is a piece of crap for doing this, he's still your dad, and you still love him, even though it's a very unhealthy relationship. After these allegations were confirmed, Becky stopped sharing a bed with her husband, and Sheila's statements eventually led to criminal charges and an arrest warrant.
And like you said earlier, that this probably should have been in the works already, but we're seeing it here kind of at the end of the social services investigation. When we get back, we'll talk about that criminal investigation and where it led Simmons for these crimes. On August 11th of 1981, 2 months after baby Sylvia was born, Simmons was charged with incest and faced up to 9 years in prison if convicted. Sheriff's deputies went to the home to arrest Simmons, only to find the entire family had packed up and left town. The manager for the New Mexico Human Services Department received an anonymous tip that the Simmons family had gone to hide in Little Rock, Arkansas. He sent a protective service alert to the Arkansas Human Services Department about the family to try to track them down and to bring Simmons to justice. The deputy director of that office said there was no reason to act on an alert from New Mexico. So here we have a little bit of miscommunication, a little bit of maybe they can't tell us what to do, but these offices not working well together in order to make this happen. And that deputy director would later say that if he had been contacted directly by the family, he would have taken action on the New Mexico alerts. But since he had no other point of reference for what was happening, he didn't feel like he needed to act. And obviously, hindsight's 20/20, but seems like something could have and should have been done.
Yeah, Gene Jr. refused to move to Arkansas. He actually stayed in New Mexico with some high school friends. Sheila was still at home with the family. And one report says that Simmons actually impregnated his daughter for a second time. However, that time Sheila had an abortion in early 1983. They lived on a plot of land that was 14 acres, and that was in Pope County, just north of Dover, Arkansas. They actually lived in a large mobile home, and they called that area Mockingbird Hill. 2 days after the family moved in, Simmons put up a no trespassing sign, just stay off my property kind of thing.
Surprised it took him 2 days.
Yeah. Soon after, he also put up a barbed wire fence. Simmons worked some small, low-paying jobs to make ends meet. And while the incest arrest warrant may have been the catalyst for moving the whole family away from New Mexico, Others believe it may have been because Sheila had started a relationship with a young man named Dennis McNulty. Sheila and Dennis met in early 1983 at the Draughton School of Business in New Mexico. Dennis was studying radio communications while Sheila was taking secretarial courses in hopes of getting a job that would let her leave home. And God, she couldn't get out of there fast enough. When Simmons moved to the family to Arkansas, that did not stop Dennis. He regularly drove 170 miles round trip to see Sheila.
And this is very dangerous for Dennis. We know that Simmons is violent. We know he's possessive about his family members and very controlling. And he continued to keep complete control over them in Arkansas as well. He was mostly verbally abusive, but was physically abusive to Becky, according to reports. He also subjected the other kids to hard labor, making them walk the property to find rocks to dig ditches. And a lot of times this was just to give them hard work to do, not something to help the family out. He was really just trying to almost institute his own military approach into the home for attitudes and discipline without the actual usefulness there. According to one family friend, the children preferred when their dad wasn't there. Least shocking thing I've ever heard. They had apparently had hideouts around the property where they would go when they could avoid Simmons when he got home. And Becky allegedly only stayed with him out of fear, again, which we often see in these domestic violence situations, that you can say all day she just needs to leave, but it's not that easy. There's so much psychologically happening there that makes you scared to death.
Yeah, he definitely had power and control issues. I mean, think back to earlier. He wouldn't even let her call or reach out to her family. She was only allowed to write letters, and then eventually he didn't even give her stamps anymore. So you can very much see that he is a domestic violent perp.
Absolutely. And Becky's sister would say, I think she was afraid to leave. She was a woman with small children and no work skills. She was too ashamed to turn to her family after the sexual abuse thing. She was just afraid and she didn't know what to do, end quote. And I think there are a lot of people in these situations that find themselves feeling the same way.
By 1987, the number of people living in this mobile home had decreased down to six. Gene Jr. was still in New Mexico and married to a woman named Wilma Sue Pitts, and that was in 1984. Sheila ended up marrying Dennis McNulty on August 11, 1984, and moved away with her daughter, Sylvia. The next oldest son, William, moved out after he got a full-time job as a shift manager at a Hardee's in Russellville. He married a woman named Renita in October of 1985. Now, the fourth oldest child was an honors student in her senior year at Dover High School, and she was pretty open about her desire to leave home as soon as possible. Yeah, I get it. By the holiday season of 1987, Becky had sent cards to her family saying how excited she was that her entire family was going to be together for Christmas. All the kids, all the grandkids were coming home. Gene Jr. and Wilma's three-year-old daughter, Barbara, were actually already there. She was staying with her grandparents while Gene Jr. and Wilma saved up for a new home. So the plan was for Barbara to come home that following February. Gene Jr. arrived at Mockingbird Hill on December 21st. Wilma had stayed behind to save money, and that would ultimately save her life.
And that's where all this is really coming to a head of the family moving away. And essentially what we see here is Simmons losing control. His kids are leaving. They're moving away. Sheila, who he had a very intimate relationship with, got married. And John, you like to put yourself in other people's shoes. I'm thinking about her new husband, Dennis, who he starts dating this woman, finds out she has a baby. That's one thing, especially in the 80s. It's quite another thing to find out that it's from incest. And yet, I don't know. Kudos to him for being somebody who is dedicated enough to step up to that. But that's a horrible situation to find yourself in as well.
Absolutely.
On December 22nd of 1987, Simmons began a gruesome and terrifying rampage. He started out by getting a firearm and shooting his wife, Becky, at close range. Then he took the gun and turned it on his oldest son, Gene Jr. At this time, Gene Jr. was just 29 years old. From there, and this is where there have been some awful violence against children and minors so far, but continues to get worse here. After he shot Gene Jr., he manually strangled Gene Jr.'s 3-year-old daughter, Barbara, until she was no longer alive. And after this, he moved their bodies into a shallow grave in the backyard that he had previously had dug by his younger children. Remember those ditches and stuff he was having them dig? He buried the bodies of his family there. That afternoon, his 4 youngest children would be dropped off by the school bus, and they were home and ready for Christmas break. This is usually a very happy time. People are elated to be off for break. But what they found, obviously, was not anything anybody would be expecting. 17-year-old Loretta, 14-year-old Eddie, 11-year-old Marianne, and 8-year-old Becky were separated by their father and each individually strangled to death. And like we said, he shot his wife and his oldest son, shot the adults, and proceeded to strangle all of these children, which is just as much about power as it is ending a life. It was thought that Simmons had also potentially held their heads underwater to just ensure that they were no longer breathing. And then he took their bodies and put them in the same pit in the backyard. When they were found, they were all still wearing their school clothes. They had just come in and immediately been attacked by Simmons. Eddie had a lunch ticket in his pocket, and the girls still had barrettes in their hair. An autopsy later showed that Loretta had tried to put up a fight before succumbing to injuries from her father. There were cuts on her face, and her watch and one of her earrings were broken. Nevertheless, he would murder his entire family with his own hands that day, at least those that were available.
Yeah, again, this was December 22nd, 1987, just a few days before Christmas. This is probably one of the most horrifying things that we've spoke about. I mean, this case, man, is the epitome of just the awfulness of domestic abuse, domestic violence, and just pure evil. So 4 days later, the day after Christmas, December 26th, 1987, that's when the rest of the Simmons family was scheduled to come over for an after Christmas dinner. So this is what Becky was excited about, to have her whole family home. William, Billy Simmons, and his wife, Renita, came over with their 20-month-old son, Trey. That's when Simmons shot and killed both 23-year-old Billy and 21-year-old Renita. Then he strangled and drowned the baby. Next, Sheila and her family arrived. Simmons shot and killed 24-year-old Sheila and her husband, 33-year-old Dennis. Then he strangled and killed the 7-year-old daughter, which again is technically his daughter, right? Because he impregnated his daughter. That was Sylvia, and then he strangled his 21-month-old grandson, Michael. He laid the bodies in neat rows in the family's living room, and they were covered in coats, except for Sheila. She was covered with Becky's best tablecloth. The babies, Michael and Trey, were wrapped in plastic sheeting and then left in cars at the end of the road.
Such a horrific scene, and so much violence. How evil do you have to be? Not only, I mean, he did this to half his family, sat for 4 days. So no remorse, no second guessing, no regret. Continues picking up killing as soon as the rest arrive. After he did all this, he drove to Sears in Russellville to pick up Christmas cards that he had ordered for his family. What in the world that seem?
Like, just don't.
Then he went drinking before he went on home, and on December 28th, 1987, was the first Monday after Christmas, so businesses had started opening up then. Simmons would write a short letter to his mother, put it in an envelope along with $250 cash, and dropped it in the mail. Then he grabbed his two 22 caliber revolvers and drove Gene Jr.'s Toyota Corolla out to Russellville. His first stop was the Peel, Eddie, and Gibbons Law Firm. That's where he found 24-year-old Catherine Kendrick. Catherine had worked with Simmons previously, and he used to send her love notes, flowers, and small gifts, and she had turned him down. So now that his old family has been killed, he's lashing out at people that had hurt him in other ways. Some friends of Kathy reported that he had recently began sending her gifts again, even though he had stopped for a while, and actually at one point showed up at Kathy's house. She tried to tell him that she was now married. She was never interested, and certainly not now. This particular day, she was at the receptionist desk when Simmons walked in, pulled out one of those .22 revolvers, and shot her repeatedly in the head. Someone quickly called the police. That was the phone call we talked about earlier, that there was a madman on the loose. Police got to the law firm at 10:17 a.m., but by the time they arrived, Simmons was gone.
Yeah, he had actually moved on to Taylor Oil Company, and there he was looking for 38-year-old Rusty Taylor. Rusty was the owner of Sinclair Mini Mart, where Simmons had worked as a part-time clerk, but he had to quit weeks earlier because he believed he was not paid enough. Simmons shot Rusty, but he survived. He also shot and killed 34-year-old J.D. Chafin. He was a firefighter and a part-time truck driver for Taylor Oil. It was Julie Mooney's first day as a bookkeeper in the office. This was probably your worst first day ever. She actually ran in to see J.D. on the ground and screamed, you know, no, you know, that's a horrific thing to see. And she actually dropped to the ground herself. I don't know if that's like just an instinct or just, I don't know, the fear caused her to do that.
Yeah, I could see it being instinct to protect yourself or just the your legs going out from under you. You didn't expect this. And this is shocking.
So she told the story later saying, quote, I believe that he thought that he had hit me and that's why he left. He just had a look in his eye like a mad dog. And when he looked at Jim on the floor and Jim was bleeding profusely, he showed no emotion or anything. He just turned around and pointed the gun at me and shot. And immediately I thought of my kids. I have an 8-year-old boy and a 15-year-old girl. And of course, then I also thought of my husband and I thought, am I dying? And my head felt warm, so I felt it. And I looked down expecting to see blood on my hand, but there was no blood. Police were called again, but again, when they got there, Simmons was already gone.
Simmons got back in his son's car and then drove over to that Sinclair Mini Mart. There, he shot and wounded Roberta Woolery and David Sawyer. Police were called again, but yet again missed Simmons. He was already on his way to the Woodline Motor Freight Company. There, he walked in, shot, and wounded Joyce Butts. Joyce was Simmons' supervisor when he had made the romantic advances on Kathy, and she reprimanded him for that and told him to leave her alone. He walked into the office this day, said nothing, and shot Joyce twice. After that, he went to a nearby office and locked the door with somebody else inside. This was Vicky Jackson. He put the gun to her head and said, "Don't worry, I'm not going to hurt you." He told Vicky, "I've done what I wanted to do, and now it's all over. I've gotten everybody who hurt me." Then, when police arrived, he would surrender. As he was being taken into custody, one of the officers straight up asked him, "Why didn't you just kill yourself when you were done with all this?" Simmons said that he was afraid he would mess it up and somehow become a vegetable and spend the rest of his life being disabled instead of just ending his suffering.
I mean, that would have been too bad, right?
Oh,
shucks. I say that tongue in cheek. Investigators determined Simmons had been planning his rampage for weeks leading up to Christmas that year of 1987. He meticulously mapped out his route in town, and he used side streets to avoid getting caught by police. When he did get caught, he refused to talk about or respond to any questions about his family once he was taken into custody. The sheriff knew from talking to people around town that Simmons had a large family, and that he also did not have permission to search Simmons' home. The judge who handled search warrants was out of town. This was long before text messaging, electronic communication. You know, you had to get a judge to sign a warrant, and that judge was out of town. So after asking Simmons about his family, the sheriff noticed that when he was asked about his family, Simmons' lip began to quiver and tears came to his eyes. And that's when the sheriff decided that this was an emergency. This had to be searched immediately to make sure his family was okay. And I think in this case, an emergency search was justified. So they went to this trailer and they found an unlocked window, and that's how they were able to enter this mobile home to determine if anyone was alive or if anybody needed help. And that's when police saw probably one of the most horrific things they have ever seen and will likely ever see in their career. They found the bodies lined up in the lounge, or in like the family room, if you will, that had been clearly killed as soon as they had, you know, arrived, either, you know, like for that dinner or whatever, and they still had their coats on. The bodies were removed from the home just after sunset, and authorities planned to search for the other missing members of the family in a large pond near the home. Again, it was getting dark, so they wanted to wait until they could see better. Then on December 29th, 1987, that's when a deputy noticed that there was a freshly dug piece of earth, and that's when the search on the pond was stopped and they moved to that fresh ground. And that's when they found the mass grave with seven bodies of his remaining family members inside of it. Other searches found the babies that were in the cars that were parked at the end of the road. The sheriff said that the walls and the ceiling in the house had been hit in by a hammer by Simmons.
So essentially just continuing to lash out in violence against the very home itself. Simmons was sent to the Arkansas State Hospital to assess his competency to stand trial, and he was found to be sane and fully aware of what he had done and capable of legally being held accountable for those actions. He was diagnosed with mixed personality disorder with narcissistic and paranoid features, which you can look that up in the DSM if you need to. It's pretty self-explanatory. The day after being taken into custody, Sheriff Boland told a reporter, "He's done nothing in his cell other than lay in his bunk with his face to the wall, just laying there," which I would think working in facility housing suspected killers is strange enough anyway, but a behavior like that kind of puts you on edge. On December 31st of 1987, the sheriff announced the autopsy results of the 14 bodies that had been found at the Simmons residence. Like we said, Becky had been shot twice in the head. Gene Jr. had been shot four times in the head and once in the abdomen. Sheila had been shot six times in the head. Dennis once in the head. Billy twice in the head. Renata five times in the head and twice in the neck. Other bodies had cords wrapped around their necks where they were strangled. Essentially, all the adult victims had been shot, and all the minors had been strangled and or drowned. Prosecutor John Bynum filed two counts of capital murder and four counts of attempted murder, and he announced he was seeking the death penalty against Robert Gene Simmons for these crimes. He also said he would eventually file charges against Simmons in the deaths of his 14 family members. So these charges are just against the people he killed out in town, or tried to kill. A trial date was set for May 9th of 1988.
So, I mean, that is just 5 months after these murders. So that's very, very quick.
That's a very speedy trial.
Simmons wanted to be put to death from the very beginning, but a death sentence is only allowed in Arkansas upon a jury's recommendation. So in order to get the jury to decide on the death penalty, Simmons had to plead not guilty and then go to trial. If he had pled guilty, the only option would have been life without the possibility of parole. So Simmons was given two court-appointed attorneys, and the trial was moved to Ozark to avoid widespread news and coverage. The trial only lasted 4 days, and witnesses gave their accounts of Simmons going into four businesses on his deadly rampage. They also presented ballistics evidence, and the defense actually rested without presenting any evidence or calling any witnesses. They basically just waved their white flag because this was a formality to get what he wanted, and that was the death penalty. So the jury deliberated for less than an hour and a half before convicting Simmons there on May 12th, 1988. After another 2 hours, they returned with the sentence, and he was indeed given the death penalty sentence. He waived his right to any appeals. On May 16th, he was actually found to be of sound mind, and he was legally able to waive those rights.
I wonder, as a legal defense attorney, somebody who's appointed, if somebody just tells you, I don't want to be defended, are you supposed to like meet the requests of your client or actually try to put on a defense? Where's your responsibility there?
Yeah, I mean, you're representing your client, right? So if that's what your client wants to do, I think you have the moral and legal obligation to educate them on the process and, you know, educate them as far as if we don't give a defense, then your piece won't be spoken and not represented. So is that what you want to do? I'm sure they probably had something signed so that he couldn't come back on them and say, I had poor counsel. I mean, they didn't even want to say anything. So I'm sure, I mean, basically they got paid to sit there for 4 days, listen about how awful their client was, and then
go to the house.
They wrote that one in.
Yeah, you're right. And he certainly did pass exams to be competent to stand trial, so he had the authority to make those decisions. In February of 1989, Simmons went on trial for the deaths of his family members. During this trial, Prosecutor Bynum offered a possible motive by presenting a letter that had gone between Simmons and his daughter Sheila, where Simmons says that he was angry that Sheila had revealed he was the father of her child. The judge ruled this letter inadmissible, though. But during a sidebar, Simmons lunged at Bynum and punched him in the face. So he's punching the prosecutor in the face while he's standing there talking to the judge. Spectators screamed, it really caused chaos. They were hiding under their seats. Simmons reached for the bailiff's gun as he was taken down by court officers. Now, if he had gotten a hold of that, he would have been put down on the spot. Jurors saw this whole thing, and some speculate that Simmons was doing this on purpose to try to push the jury to have no choice but to convict him and give him the death penalty. The prosecution had 18 witnesses, and again, the defense didn't present a single witness or item of evidence. Simmons was found guilty after the jury deliberated for 4 hours, which I have to assume included a 3.5 hour coffee break. 2.5 hours later, they came back in with another penalty of the death sentence.
There were years of back and forth arguing over whether Simmons had the right to waive his right to appeal his death penalty conviction. The assistant attorney general continued to remind Simmons that he could stop the execution at any time in order to pursue his right to appeal. Simmons, though, was not interested in an appeal. Again, from the beginning, he wanted to be put to death. On May 31st, a name that you might be familiar with, the then governor of Arkansas, Bill Clinton, signed an execution warrant for Ronald Gene Simmons. Before his execution, which took place on June 25th, 1990, Simmons gave a brief and, in my opinion, a confusing statement saying, quote, justice delayed, finally had to be done, is justifiable homicide.
Yeah.
I don't know what that means. Clearly, he is a crazy person, and I'm not even going to try to figure out what was in his head. Simmons was put to death at 9 p.m. by lethal injection. Interesting fact, he was actually the first person killed by lethal injection in the state of Arkansas. He had no surviving relatives. I mean, he literally killed everyone in his family. And any surviving relatives, like distant relatives that he did have, refused to claim his body. And I think that if I'm a distant relative to this guy, it's not my responsibility. So he was actually buried in Lincoln Memorial Lawn Cemetery. His sister Nancy was present for the funeral. God bless Nancy, because I don't know that I could be there. This was, in all the cases we've ever done, this one clearly a monster. And I genuinely do not know what happened to this guy to cause so much hatred to be in his life and for him to act on the things that, I mean, it started with incest and rape and ended in him brutally murdering every one of his, I mean, this is just insane, man.
It really is. And I don't know that there is a cause. That's kind of the scary part of it. We talk about people like this all the time, and often there is some kind of trigger, there's some kind of childhood trauma, and I'm sure he had a hard time in different ways, but nothing that would ever come close to justifying anything that we've talked about today. And He's we've talked before. We are, I think, each not huge fans of the death penalty, but I'm not losing any sleep on this one. I hope that there was something that could be learned here. We know that he continued to abuse his family even after he had raped his daughter. We know that he continued to go on this killing rampage and police kept missing him. And I know communication was tougher back then, but still, I feel like something could have been done to at least slow him down.
Vietnam was an awful war, and I think some people may say that his childhood or his experiences in Vietnam could have led to some of the domestic violence that we saw here, and maybe that it is a contributing factor.
Sure.
We have people at our church, like there's a guy that, like, just the best guy I've ever met is a Vietnam vet at our church, and he would never think about hurting his family. He's a just genuinely a great guy after seeing some of the most evil crap in the world. So I don't know why this guy chose to do it. I don't know what made him evil, but ultimately your actions are a choice, and he chose to go down a path of violence and evil.
In the worst way possible. Absolutely. And yeah, I don't want to try to dismiss any sort of issues that individuals have coming back from military service. That's a very real struggle. A lot of people go through that, and it is, like you said, very real, but so were his decisions and so were those violent acts, especially after sitting in that home for 4 days with dead bodies in the backyard and then killing more.
That's what, you know, if there's questions that I would have, it would be, what was he doing during those 4 days? Was he on site? Was he there living amongst that evil? Or right. Did he see his carnage and have to go elsewhere? But I mean, there's no way you could ever defend this being anything but first degree murder, because this was meticulously planned. He knew when his kids were getting home. He knew when people were planning to get there for the after Christmas dinner party, and he was waiting on them. I mean, he was not surprised by any of this. And then to drive into town and take his rampage even further, this guy knew what he was doing, and he had a well-orchestrated plan.
He really did, and thankfully he will not be carrying out any more violence like this. And I know this was a tough one, always tough when kids are involved in this kind of thing, but we appreciate you all hanging out with us till the very end to find that as much as it possibly could be here, justice was served. Obviously, we're not bringing back anyone, and this is not going to undo anything, but to the fullest extent of the law, justice was carried out, and this one is over, and I'm very thankful for that.
Me too, man, but you know, it always is a pleasure to sit here with you on these microphones and talk, and but this one was tough for sure.
Absolutely. And guys, we really appreciate you listening. We appreciate everything you do for our show, whether that's getting on Patreon or writing reviews. Those are all super helpful and help get the word out there about True Crime Cast. We've been doing this for almost 8 years and still growing. So anything you can do to help us, we would be forever in your debt.
That being said, until next crime, this has been True Crime Cast.
You've listened to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.